You know, apathy, it's such a tricky word because it can change so quickly. And I mean, that was one of the things that was so amazing about what happened in this city in 1999, right? Because all we ever heard in the 90s was how apathetic young people were. And I remember when I was writing No Logo, which was a book about anti-corporate branding and also young people engaging in anti-corporate activism, I couldn't find an American publisher. And Rick was mentioning our mutual friend, my editor at Picador, but that was the only publishing house that would take No Logo, because every single publisher in the U.S. told me that they were really interested in it and that they cared about it, but that young people today are so apathetic. And I remember this one editor at Knopf in New York said to me, you know, I'm really interested in world politics, but young people in America want to read memoirs of eating disorders. And then when the Seattle protests happened, she called me. She's like, do you have any other books that you're writing? No, just simply in terms of the disillusionment around voting, I mean, I think that, you know, I think what we suffer from more is less apathy than learned helplessness. Learned helplessness is actually, you know, it's a psychological phrase based on these weird experiments that they did on dogs, where, does people know what I'm referring to? The learned helplessness.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, if you get zapped and you get zapped and you try to escape and you can't escape, then you stop trying, right? You know, think about the 2006 midterm elections, right? I mean, if people don't want to vote in the next presidential elections after that experience, it's not because they're apathetic. It's because they've been learning helplessness, right? So I think, you know, a lot of it also has to do with telling each other our victory stories as well. You know, I think that one of the most disempowering, you know, we sometimes think the media doesn't do a good enough job of telling us how bad things are. And I really started to think that the bigger problem is that we never hear success stories. You know, we never hear about people who did organize their, you know, Starbucks outlet or an indigenous group in Ecuador that successfully kicked out a mining company. You know, we'll hear about the mining companies and, you know, the despoiling of land. You know, that's the kind of story that actually does get out once in a while. But you almost never hear about the victories because they actually challenge that. So I think that's part of it. I'll come back to that question. I mean, the only thing I would just add to that, you know, is I really totally agree that this is the huge push. This is the education and Social Security are the next frontiers for total privatization. And, you know, I've referred to disaster zones as laboratories for what they want to do all the time and everywhere. Milton Friedman wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal 3 months after the levees broke. He said teachers and parents and students are scattered all over the United States. The city lies in ruins. This is a tragedy. It is also an opportunity to radically remake the education system. And then he proceeded to prescribe privatization of the public school system, which ended up being picked up by the charter school advocates. New Orleans is now the leading laboratory in the United States for charter schools. Half the students in New Orleans are going to charter schools. There used to be just 4 charter schools in New Orleans. Now I think they're around 50. And the public school system has been left to erode even more. They're completely skewing the results because these charter schools will perform better because they're excluding the most disadvantaged students in New Orleans because they can select the students that they want. So students who have very serious emotional and physical challenges, particularly because of the disaster there, are being excluded and are being dumped onto this public school system that is being starved out, while the charter schools are being showered with money from the right-wing think tanks and from Laura Bush's foundation. And, you know, the reason for that is they want these results. They want to be able to point to New Orleans, and we're going to hear it even more and more, to show that this works so that they can generalize it. And, I mean, the one other thing I would say is, you know, some of you may have heard me debate Alan Greenspan on Democracy Now! The other day. Unfortunately, as part of the preparation for that little encounter, I had to read Alan Greenspan's book. And the overarching message of his book, you know, I mean, in that exchange, he actually said it, where I asked him whether he keeps warning about this dangerous rise of economic populism, which I just think is fantastic. But apparently Alan Greenspan thinks, you know, and keep this in mind about the apathy, Alan Greenspan thinks that the public is losing faith in trickle-down economics, and this is very dangerous. He's worried about it. And I asked him whether he might share some of the responsibility for this loss of faith in trickle-down economics, seeing as he presided over a period in the United States where, you know, when Reagan took office, the CEOs made 43 times as much as their workers, and when Alan Greenspan left the Federal Reserve, they made, I think, 488 times as much as their workers. And, you know, I proceeded to list the ways in which his policies had fed this: free trade, outsourcing, you know, the dot-com crash, now the subprime crash, deregulation of everything, the breaking of unions. He blamed the education system. He said that that's the reason for inequality in America. Americans are too dumb because of the bad teachers. He blamed the teachers. And he does it again and again in the book. So it's chilling. It's scary, you know. And the next time there is the slightest window of opportunity, there's going to be a radical push, a radical attack on the education system, and we have to be ready. Okay. Those are two great questions. I'm going to try not to, like, give a speech for each. Which I easily could. All right. Project for a New American Century, you know, this is often held up, this document is often held up as sort of the smoking gun for the theory that 9/11 was an inside job, because, you know, it's signed by all of very many of the key players in the Bush administration, and they lay out their agenda for world domination, much of which they have achieved. But they say in the document, you know, this agenda is not possible, you know, absent an event like a new Pearl Harbor, right? So, you know, they're saying that they need a crisis to push forward with their agenda. But see, what I do in the book is I have many documents like that, from top level economists at the World Bank, at the IMF. John Williamson, who is the person who coined the phrase the Washington Consensus and codified exactly what it is. You know, I have a quote from John Williamson saying that they've never been able to impose the Washington Consensus in the absence of a large-scale crisis. And he says, you know, given the beneficial effects of crisis, should we not consider creating a pseudo-crisis to reap the beneficial effects of reform? There's tons of documents in which you have people anticipating or wanting a crisis in order to push forward an agenda that they wouldn't be able to do otherwise. You mentioned, you know, other documents. I haven't seen the documents that you're referring to, but, you know, obviously the Third Reich practiced the shock doctrine and used crisis, and they aren't the only ones. I mean, In this book, I am not arguing by any means that this particular group of Chicago School economists and their, you know, the politicians who enact their policies are the first group of people in the world to exploit crisis to advance their political goals. This is the oldest trick in the book. What their use of it shows us is how deeply anti-democratic their agenda is. You know, it's not a coincidence that the other people who spring to mind are fascists and dictators, including on the left, right? I mean, this urge to blank the slate and to start from year zero, I mean, I'm using this language very consciously. And what I start the book saying, the left has been held accountable for the crimes required to impose the ugliest forms of its ideology. And we have actually confronted this past. I think we've learned from this past. And I believe that that's why, that when we look to Latin America, we see the rise of social movements like the Zapatistas and the MST, that participatory democracy is at the dead center of these movements. And they are building in the rubble of a failed system. This is a response to the disaster that is neoliberalism, but it's a response that is radically inclusive, that is, of course, using crisis as an opportunity, if you will, but not to blast people out of the way, as Milton Friedman was suggesting, like, yay, the teachers are away and the parents are away, we can remake the education system. But this is a crisis and an opportunity to build a more democratic, more equal society than we had before. And, Milton Friedman was very aware, his nemesis was Keynes, and he was very aware that that the crisis of the Great Depression, that the market crash of 1929 had been a catalyst for progressives, for socialists, and for Keynesians to build the New Deal, and that's why they have this mission to exploit every crisis and make sure that the ideas are lying around the next time the crisis hits. Now, that's a mission statement for the Heritage Foundation, for the American Enterprise Institute. This is not an organic intellectual movement that is bubbling up from below. It's a corporate-funded intellectual movement that makes sure that those ideas are ready to go when the next shock hits. Okay. So in terms of the motives for the players, I don't want to be flip about it. But I do, I think it's very complicated. It's a very rare person who can pursue very damaging policies and without some kind of intellectual framework that serves as a rationale for that activity, right? I mean, people do horrifying things. Very rarely do they do them without some claim to a higher good. I mean, it's the role that Christianity played for colonialism. And it is the role that, supremacy, a vision of racial supremacy plays. It is a belief that you are actually building something purer and better that rationalizes extraordinary violence. Once again, the same for state communists, that rationalizes it. It is the belief in utopia that rationalizes mass purges and work camps, erasing of societies. Okay, so what is free market ideology? I believe it is a rationale. Okay, I don't really believe that it is that people fall in love with the idea of trickle-down economics. And then go decide to be capitalists, okay? I think that the role that trickle-down economic theory generally plays is it's like the friend you call, like, after you've done something you're a little embarrassed about, and they go, don't worry, you deserve it. That's Milton Friedman for the capitalist class. And I'll just give you an example, because he's very much on our minds this evening, Alan Greenspan. In his autobiography, which I had absolutely no intention of plugging this evening, because I really urge you not to read it. I'm giving you the best parts, okay? In his autobiography, he talks about his own political awakening. And what's interesting is that as a student, he was a student at a time when studying economics was infused with a sense of purpose, because it was after the Second World War, and there was very much a sense that Keynesianism was in vogue, and the sense was that economists, the mission was to prevent an economic crisis like the one that had happened in Germany and created the conditions for the rise of fascism. So these were very heady times for students. To think about the role of economics in building social justice and in fighting dangerous forces in society. Alan Greenspan, by his own admission, couldn't have cared less, okay? He was not interested. He says he was not interested in big ideas. He was just good at math, and he was good at business, and he got his first jobs being an economic forecaster for some of the largest corporations in America. Not an ideas guy, not thinking about how to make the world a better place, okay? Even though lots of people around him were, okay? Then he stumbles across the works of Ayn Rand, okay? And has a political awakening, all right? And, you know, Ayn Rand is just pulped up Adam Smith and Milton Friedman, right? I mean, it's just, it's pulp fiction of, you know, radical capitalism, right? I mean, the climax of Atlas Shrugged, you know, somebody writes a dollar sign in the sky as a benediction, right? This isn't subtle stuff. There's a chapter called The Utopia of Greed, okay? And so Ayn Rand's philosophy is that greed is the governing force, the best governing force of society, that any attempt to do good is bad and doing bad is good. And Alan Greenspan goes, yeah, and becomes a Randroid, as they were called. But which, you know, which is simply to say that the role of this ideology, you know, it's I don't think we should give it too much respect, I guess, because for him, what he said is that he had always respected the efficiency of markets. But what Rand taught him was the morality of markets, i.e. she infused what he was already doing with this claim to a higher goal, a higher morality. So I think it's sinister. Okay, your first question about what is the international law framework for an occupying power in making, in ensuring that its economy develops. I suppose it's fairly unclear. There's only two reference points. There's the Hague Regulations and the Geneva Conventions. Those are the two pieces of international law that govern occupying powers. What they both say is that, occupying powers have a responsibility to safeguard the assets of a country that they are occupying, which is to say that, I mean, the reason why these laws exist, the heading in the before the section in the Hague Regulations, the little subhead is pillage is forbidden. You know, you think you shouldn't have to write this down, but you. It's a heading, Pillage is Forbidden. It's my favorite part. I actually thought about calling the book Pillage is Forbidden. Also, I thought about calling it Friedman Fighter. you know, the point is, if you, the reason why what Paul Bremer was doing, I mean, he was claiming that these policies were so uncontested, and this is the specialty of neoliberal economists, is to present highly ideological, highly contested policies as technocratic and uncontested, right? So they were saying that all they were doing was developing Iraq's economy and safeguarding their assets by privatizing them and, you know, laying off workers and doing everything, you know, that from the Washington Consensus Handbook. But there's a lot of international lawyers came to the opinion that this was illegal under the Hague Regulations, obviously because they were privatizing the assets, and in fact this was a large part of the reason why the privatization was called off, because it was in such a legal gray zone that quite a few international lawyers, and I quoted them at the time, were saying that if an Iraqi government came to power, an elected Iraqi government came to power, and decided to reverse the privatizations and expropriate these assets from the foreign companies that had bought them, that they very well could have the legal right to do it because the privatizations were illegal under international law in the first place. The analogy I used at the time in terms of what the international law says about this is that it's basically a house-sitting rule. Like, an occupier is a house-sitter. Like, you know, you've got to take care of the house while you're occupying it, which means you can kind of, you know, you can sleep in the bed and you can eat the food in the fridge, but you can't, you know, just bulldoze the house and turn it into condos. That's not allowed. And that is essentially what the U.S. attempted to do in Iraq. You talked about the fact that obviously there has to be a private sector role of some kind in supplying the government. You know, and we're talking about this contractor economy. you know, there are always going to be contractors because government's not going to make everything that it uses. It needs to, you know, buy everything from, you know, pencil sharpeners to, sadly, guns. And there are all kinds of rules that govern government contracting. And what the Bush administration has done is really erode that set of rules to massively expand the contractor economy. I have a stat in the book that there were 15,000 contracts handed out to for security products in 2002. And in 2005, there were 115,000. Okay? So that's and I think it's something like, the New York Times just reported on this, and I could be wrong, but I think it's something like 70% of the contracts that are being handed out are no bid, right? So, I mean, the bidding is one of the ways that you try to have some accountability. But then the other thing, the other framework for government contracting is that, you know, because this is not part of the free market economy, because it's an entirely, you know, it is a state economy, the contractor economy. It actually gives the government a great deal of control to make all kinds of demands of their contractors. You know, so you can demand a higher level you can demand that contractors pay better wages than normal corporations working in the private sector, because, you know, if these corporations are going to be getting, you know, making their business from public money, the public can make demands of those contractors. And that's why you have something like the Davis-Bacon, which says that any government contractor has to pay prevailing wages, not the minimum wage, but prevailing wages. And this was one of the first things that Bush changed after Hurricane Katrina. It was the first piece of legislation that he passed was to say that contractors working in New Orleans didn't have to pay prevailing wage. And that's why there was a huge amount of migrant workers who came to New Orleans to do that reconstruction work and were paid just, you know, slave level wages, and, you know, had huge debts that they had paid to labor contractors to get there in the first place. So, yeah, there's all kinds of things that can be done. They are systematically being dismantled. I mean, in Iraq, you could have said to the Halliburtons and Bechtels, and, you know, I have to say I hate talking about this because I really, the war was illegal. It failed because it was an illegal war, and Iraq is owed massive reparations. So I really don't like to get into sort of the nitty-gritty of if they had occupied them more better, it would have been okay. I mean, I don't think it ever could have been okay. But that said, I mean, if you look at... The state holds all the cards in a contractor economy. It has the contracts, and it can put whatever conditions it wants on the corporations that are getting these contracts because it is not in the private sector. So in Iraq, there could have been a rule that Bechtel had to hire 100% Iraqis to do the work in Iraq, which would have made a huge difference in that country, because a large amount of the rage had to do with watching foreigners come in and take these jobs that Iraqis could have performed themselves. So, you know, there's all kinds of things that you can do that weren't done, because the theory behind it was simply that you just create the conditions for the most profits to be made, and the country will just rebuild itself on the, you know, the creative cauldron of capitalism. So the question about the Ford Foundation, I do have a section in the book. I'm not going to get into it in great depth now, about the role of the Ford Foundation in funding the human rights movement in Latin America. The Ford Foundation had also funded the Chicago Boys. They were the major funders besides the U.S. State Department. And so there was a real irony in Latin America, because the Ford Foundation had played such a key role in training the economists who had worked with the dictatorships in imposing these brutal policies. But then the Ford Foundation also funded many of the lawyers who tried to get people out of jail. And what I argue in the book is that this created a strange specialization where the human rights movement really couldn't ask why this violence was happening. And it was, you know, very legalistic and narrow. And it's part of the reason why you had like the sort of economic strain, and then you had the human rights strain of activism in this region, and they were never allowed to intersect. And I say in the book, you know, these contradictions are so stark that in 1976, Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize for policies that were being implemented with blood and fire in Latin America. And in 1977, Amnesty International won the Nobel Prize for their crusading work in Argentina and Chile. Cleaning up after Milton Friedman's policies. The question was about the question of whether foundations have a demobilizing effect on progressive movements in the United States. And I would have to say, I think that in general, the professionalization of activism and the replacing of activism with an aid framework can be very, very dangerous. And I think we really see this really clearly in disaster zones, where you have moments. You know, I was just in New Orleans on the second anniversary of the levees breaking. I was there for this extraordinary exchange that was organized by a wonderful NGO called ActionAid International. And ActionAid International does a lot of great work critiquing the NGO, what in New Orleans they call the NGO industrial complex. They had facilitated this wonderful exchange between community organizers in Tamil Nadu, India, who had been fighting land grabs after the tsunami, an exchange between those amazing organizers who represented movements sometimes of 50,000 people, just huge movements in India, and they brought them to New Orleans to meet with community organizers in New Orleans, and a group from New Orleans had also gone to India, and so this was a really interesting exchange where they were talking about disaster capitalism and how it manifested itself in their respective countries. But the delegates from India, you know, we were touring the Lower Ninth Ward and looking at, you know, what had happened there, you know, and you see, you know, there's no water, the homes have just been leveled, and the weeds are growing, and nothing's happened. And one of the organizers from India turned to me and said, if this happened in India, we'd have a revolution. And in thinking about why there wasn't more of a revolt in New Orleans, a lot of people pointed to the role of the foundations and the NGOs as a demobilizing force. You know, this was a moment of rage and rebellion. And it should have been, because this was a theft of a city. It was an armed robbery. And that rage, you know, that was a radical and important and well-deserved rage, was dampened down, you know, by this infrastructure that descended on the city and on the, you know, the shelters around it, of just keeping everybody waiting for like the potential of some sort of charity that was going to fix everything. And of course, in 99% of the cases, the charity really didn't come, and the homes weren't rebuilt. But that moment kind of drained away, and I've seen that dampening down impact. And I don't think it's really a grand conspiracy, but I do think that at high levels, of government, there is an understanding that it's way better to have NGOs than it is to have social movements that are a hell of a lot harder to control. I will end on that note.
Naomi Klein, speaking in Seattle, on her new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Some of her previous books on related topics include No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, and Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate.
How many times do you have to ask? The answers never get you far. You're not sure what your life is for, but you're doing all you can. What changes should you plan to make? And what difference would it make? If you look beyond your doubts and fears, happiness isn't far away. We don't have to be fantastic. We don't even have to be able to walk on the moon. We won't have to live forever. You can write your life off changing yourself. What robots are born to be gigantic. The world's too small. Why the need for domination? Can't we just be one nation? We won't have to live forever. You can write your life off changing yourself. Sometimes pain can make us fall. What makes everyone so different? Can only be skin deep. What's the deal with being the only one? There's millions more just like you. Hold your head up and join the team. 'Cause happiness isn't far away. We don't have to be fantastic. We don't even have to be able to walk on the moon. We won't have to live forever. You can write your life off changing yourself. What's the point of being gigantic? The world's too small. Why the need for domination? Can't we just be one nation? We won't have to live forever. You can write your life off changing yourself.
Conclude the program with the next installment of the serial reading of Forgiving, a feminist critique of exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. A friend of mine commented to me recently on how difficult the readings can be to follow on the radio. They are difficult, so thank you for persevering with it. Vaughn is analyzing the building blocks of our culture from a different perspective and taking care to prove her case. Her argument is that in order to understand the social implications and presumptions underlying exchange as our primary form of social relations, we must put it into the larger picture of patriarchy and how patriarchy perpetuates itself through language. One of the results of this is that relationships based on gift-giving, which also exist in our society, are discounted or uncounted. Since the mother-child relationship is the primary and formative human relationship, as well as the archetype for the gift paradigm, it has to be deliberately put aside from its natural role as the human example, which she calls the sample. Our language, which shapes our thoughts as we learn it, embeds instead a patriarchal sample based on the domination of others. In the early chapters of the book, she pointed out that our words community and communication come from the Latin root muni, which means gift, and that our original understanding of community is literally giving gifts together, and that communication is also a fundamentally gift-based interaction, where speech is a word gift given in response to another's need for information or recognition. In our reading last week, she made the distinction between the social effects of exchange and of giving. Central to the process of giving and receiving is the recognition of the value and importance of the person who is receiving, an acknowledgement of their needs being met as a matter of importance to the giver, In other words, a giver validates the humanity of a receiver, and a receiver recognizes the gift of the giver in this way. These interactions form the basis of the bonds of community. Exchange, on the other hand, is an interaction where each party is acting to meet their own needs without concern for the other person. The brutality and callousness Naomi Klein focused on in her discussion of the shock doctrine can be seen as an ultimate consequence of the relationship of exchange. This is a point that many will find particularly difficult to accept, as we are told that a concept of fairness and equity lies at the heart of exchange, of markets, and at the heart of our legal system, which is understood as a social contract. But when the market is unmasked, success is viewed as what Vaughan calls overtaking, having an advantage over others. In spite of the pretense of equity and fairness, exchange is at heart a hostile interaction, and therefore destructive of community. If you made a good deal, by implication, the other person didn't. You succeed in the market by paying less than something is worth and making the other person pay more than it's worth. Vaughan has described profit as a gift coerced from the worker by the capitalist and by extension from the worker's caregivers, whose unpaid efforts to meet the worker's needs at home increase the worker's ability to produce for the capitalist. The gift paradigm, conversely, is about meeting others' needs, just as a mother feeds a child who's hungry without placing an exchange value on it. If a mother were to act like a capitalist and demand an exchange of goods or services for the food she gives her child, she would be condemned by society as an unfit mother. Yet a capitalist who controls and withholds what others need, if they can't provide exchange value, is viewed as normal or even admirable, while those who criticize this as a cruel social arrangement are condemned as foolish or even dangerous. Now, to Foregiving, a Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughan, continuing in Chapter 7 with the section Parasitic Relations. Vaughan writes, "Altruism may sometimes seem fake, but that is because the artificial, masculated exchange ego has learned how to do altruism, but not in a mothering way. Paternalistic charities give small amounts, just enough to take the pressure off a few individuals without changing the big picture. They maintain control of their gifts and of the receivers through due diligence, with the idea that the receivers have to earn their trust. Then women, even mothers, overvaluing these charitable, quote, procedures, take them as the norm of how to be altruistic. If women continue to discredit the model, concept, sample of mothering, to look at it only from the self-reflecting and self-validating point of view of masculation and exchange, whether this is due to our own success in the system or to our taking the point of view of the overvalued male other who degrades us, we will lose the revolutionary, the re-evolutionary potential that now inflames the heart of the worldwide women's movement. Having for centuries accepted the male bill of goods that we were inferior, and now accepting the bill of goods that we are or should be, quote, equal to their model, we risk relinquishing our alignment with Mother Earth, our possibility of saving her, our mothers, ourselves, our daughters, and our sons, from the hungry mirror of the exchange paradigm. This is a species that is eating itself alive because it cannot value the concept sample of the abundantly giving mother or even see her. We have made gift-giving, which is the source of life and joy, a slave to the artificial masculated ego and its expressions at the economic, political, and ideological levels. This drains the gifts of humanity into the coffers of the few, whose priapic excesses are kept from the needs and transformed into phallic armaments, deadly marks by which one group can demonstrate its superiority over another, which is forced to give way. In this way, the constrained gifts of the many are wasted on non-nurturing expenditures of destruction, not to mention the immolation of millions of gift-giving hearts, minds, and bodies. By unmaking the bodies of the community, communication turns against itself in the image of the concept sample. Meanwhile, this same process, supplying the needs of war, conveniently destroys the abundance which would have facilitated gift-giving in parts of the world not directly affected by the war. We've created a many-tiered relation in which a relatively small number of people act as a parasite on the rest, creating a situation of privilege which is originally created by transferring half of all our babies into a linguistically mediated, non-nurturing, superior category. This category is overvalued and given to by the nurturers because of its mandate to achieve the concept sample position. The host must re-educate and convince the parasite, which is anyway part of itself. We must not allow the parasite to continue to convince the host. The parasite is made of mirrors, exchanges, definitions, judgments, and it has to receive energy, money, food, time, nurturing from somewhere else in order to grow big enough to become a privileged one by overcoming many others. But this aberrant state of affairs is not anybody's fault. In fact, blame and guilt are part of the exchange paradigm, ways of making the other pay back. We cannot fix the exchange paradigm by reapplying it again and again to itself. Our prisons and electric chairs are overflowing with people, quote, paying for their mistakes. We do not need justice. We need kindness. Justice is really an attempt to define the crime so that it will not happen again. We try to perform this definition through a kind of exchange because exchange derives from the definition. The payment involves a forced material communication whereby the criminal is required to give up something and give way. Perhaps we believe that by returning to the material level requiring goods, time, or even life in a, quote, equal exchange, we will have more effect upon the wrongdoer. An attempt is made to evaluate the gravity of the crime with respect to other crimes, a kind of quantification. The criminal is emasculated again, physically distanced, and put into a category of other with a term or a sentence. And I'm reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughan. Light and Shadow. Women can also develop a self-focused ego, but we often remain to some extent other-oriented because we continue to be required to be the nurturers of our children. Inside or outside academia, our worldviews are likely to be broader than men's, especially when we are not intellectually subservient to the patriarchal way. With one foot in each camp, it's easier to see the contradictions. In fact, what we see is that we are standing half in the shadow, half in the light. Even when we compete and succeed in the exchange economy, as individuals, we often view ourselves as belonging to the masses of women who are unseen and unrecognized. Our places in the shadow also lets us look at others who are in the dark. The masses of people, cultures, women, children and men who are placed in the background by the masculated ego. Along with these are all the things, animals, creatures, plants, inventions, art, and household effects which have been the objects of our care, use, and maintenance throughout the centuries. Here in the dark lie all the tables we have polished, corn we have ground, fields we have planted, horses, cows, and chickens we have fed, snow we have shoveled, roofs we have thatched, assembly lines we have worked in, sinks we have unstopped, dances we have danced, children we have raised. In all this variety of activity, we have conferred value upon things and imbued them with the stuff of life freely, which others may freely use. Even when our activity has cost us a lot, humanly or economically, the results of our acting according to nurturing principles still remains as a free legacy for others. The legacy consists of material reality. The house that was lived in and taken care of that has survived to this day, the one that was abandoned has decayed and gone. Caring ways and unmasculated value giving hearts and minds. The male ego notoriously fears death and loves what it fears, because by shifting its vision away from others, it denies what it has received from them and their existence and importance for it as well. Thus, it's likely to see itself as the lonely source of what instead has been given to it by others, from the masses of humanity that preceded it, to the workers in its factories and fields, to its mother, wife, sister, child, and even at times brother. This is a bit rare, because the old boys' network and male bonding serve to increase the sense of power and autonomy of the isolated male ego as such. Men learn to recognize the self-reflecting image and validate each other. The one position works particularly well within the denial of the fact that it has received it from others. The ego sees everything in the framework of taking, or at least of deserving what it gets. Deserving is another transposition of exchange, requiring an equivalence between past actions and present rewards. The emphasis that we have put on the monetization of labor in capitalism has concentrated attention only on that area of our activity and on the kind of human relation which is, quote, making money. Since the ego thinks of its perceptions, its world, and its abilities as all coming from itself, its own social artificial character is concealed from it, and it runs the risk of solipsism. Looking at language from the point of view of the gift paradigm is a good cure for solipsism. If we consider each word as a byproduct of the linguistically mediated life process of the multitudes of people before us, by which they satisfied each other's communicative needs and which is also freely given to us, we find ourselves in contact with millions of other gift-giving and communicating people, because we have received our words and our culture and our material goods from them. Actually, solipsism is not so much a philosophical position in our society as a psychological and a political one. It allows cruelty without responsibility, blissing out in our own well-being in the face of others' pain. Our compassion withers and dries up, and our souls become prisoners of our egos. We allow governments to make innumerable decisions which kill other people or let them die, perpetrating economic and military genocide while we stay safely at home, wondering whether those other people really existed in the first place. People who talk about creating our own reality are perhaps unknowingly inspired by the limitless creativity and magical quality of the gift of language, without, however, acknowledging the source of the gift as others in general. Some religious attitudes, both New Age and fundamentalist, are prone to weaseling out of the human race so as not to feel powerless among the multitude, and instead to belong only to the privileged one position. When we begin to relate only to God, who is often also seen as a masculated one, and therefore similar to each one of us as an isolated individual, and not to the human race and the planet, our attitude tends to become megalomaniacal and paranoid. Then we act in singularly discompassionate ways, ignoring those people outside our immediate focus, whose spirituality, after all, is just as great or small as our own. if we can reconceptualize ourselves as having received from the people of the past and present, beginning with our own mothers, we are no longer separate and disempowered. In fact, seeing oneself as a masculated ego, not receiving from others except through deserving, really does make us powerless. Then we overcompensate. At any rate, solipsism is disproved by the fact that we think in language, which we have gotten from others. There used to be a creationist theory that God had buried those dinosaur bones out there to test our faith in the Bible story of Genesis. Similarly, for solipsists, she/he would have implanted language in our minds to test our faith by making us suspect there were other people out there. Actually, our earth is so vast and varied that we could never begin to live on it as individuals. We need the common perceptions of the many to give any kind of real context to our individual lives. Society is a sort of enormous fly's eye which, by putting together its many facets into a collective vision, is able to see the big picture. This picture is facilitated and transcribed into language in order to mediate our social relations with each other. And the transcription, in turn, provides a sort of enormous collective eardrum which reverberates in response to everything that is important at a certain threshold of intensity beyond the individual level. Through collective elaboration, the cultural values of the things the community responds to are stored in words, kept alive as gifts available for all, constantly in use. Still, the patriarchal ego looks only at the things which are within its own focus, shining its own light upon them. It is because people, in the first place, in the so-called first world, are in this mode that we were able to ignore the flow of goods, money, and value from the so-called third world at home and abroad to us. When the CIA is not directly destabilizing third world governments, or the U.S. funding fascist tyrants against the interests of the many poor, first world patriarchy takes over economically. While our media and our therapy focus on the here and now, our government uses our money, their influence, and their armaments to devastate the people in the dark. Big businesses relocate to the third world, causing economic and environmental disaster, while some of us at home reap profits and others lose their jobs. When the businesses are unable to hide, they cover up with lies, redefining what they do as development. Under the appearance of helping people, they bring the gift mode into focus, though falsely, to cover the bitter exchange mode, exploitative things that they are really doing. This has the effect of portraying the gift mode as something other than it is, and of identifying it with the men, especially in government and business, who are farthest away from the truth. Often, as individuals, these men have never nurtured anybody, having themselves always functioned within the exchange mechanism. Our first world needs are actually being satisfied free or at very low cost to us by, quote, third world people. An equivalent of their work does not go back to them. The difference in the economies allows the business people to pocket most of the price we pay them, put it in our banks, transferring that value one more time from the have-nots to the haves, from the dark to the light, the invisible to the visible. Like a lock in a river, the flow of value is blocked and maintained at a, quote, higher level. The first world economies as a whole have received an enormous amount from the third world economies. Individually, it may be hard to see this, or we may not feel the benefit directly. But the much larger amount of value circulating here than there is due to the unequal exchange, an exchange which in practice ends up as a free gift from the third world people to us. Our short-term profit motive, which fits so well with the privileged ego mode, lets the people in the dark, those of the past, those of the present third world at home or abroad, and those of the future, all our children, be damaged or destroyed by poverty, pollution, and war, to pay for what is in the light, our own continued well-being. The problem is not moral depravity and a psychological penchant towards greed, but a, quote, normal worldview, an ego structure, and an economic way which fit and function together to the detriment of all. Individually, I do not think we know we are doing this or we would stop, make each other stop. Collectively, our consciousness is in denial, which makes it hard to come to individual consciousness. That is why we so desperately need a paradigm shift. The mandate towards overtaking and being one by having and domination is broadcast at every level in our society. The scarcity that is artificially created by the powers that be in order to maintain the system of exchange intensifies the penalties for not succeeding in the mandate. We do not realize that it is logically impossible for everyone to be a one related to the many, and that no other life agenda is available to most males beyond masculation per se. Meaningful work, education, and entertainment are offered almost exclusively to economic haves, and all of those areas are anyway part of the exchange economy. Gangs and criminal behavior are the only chance many people have to carry out the masculated life agenda, though violence against women continues to be an option for males needing to act as dominant ones. While all of these activities needed to be defined as wrong, it is only through a revision and redefinition of society itself that the problem can be solved. We have to shift paradigms and educate everyone into the nurturing way, not masculate our boy babies into an ego structure that requires dominance and privilege to feel it is carrying out its gender identity mandate. We have to restore the mothering model for all, educate our boys to be gift givers too, from the beginning. After they have had to give up the mother and learn how not to nurture, how can they at a later date learn to be, quote, good by following the rules, the behavioral syntax deriving from the naming of gender, the overtaking law of the father? And I've been reading from Forgiving, a Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn, originally published in 1997. The entire book is available for download online at the website forgiving.com. That's forgiving.com. And you can download this program and all previous episodes on the web at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, The Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. One day and they'll kill me, then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by